This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks with Michelle Owen, Alex Crook and Sam Matterface.
Hello everyone, I'm Sam Matterface from ITV and TalkSport, and this is the second instalment of All Football Commentators Are Geeks. Well, the first proper episode really, hopefully without any stray dogs interrupting any of the proceedings. Over the next 40 minutes, we aim to give you a unique insight into the weird and exhilarating world of football broadcasting, taking you so close to the profession you can basically taste the pressroom food, feel the cold on the TV gantry, sample the manager's press conferences, and feel the loneliness of the dreaded Premier League mix zone. Joining me today, a hat-trick of heavyweight sports hacks, well, and we're not just talking about Crookie's waistline, geekier than Lisa from The Simpsons, we have
Michelle Owen from Sky Sports News and Soccer Saturday.
Alex Crook, TalkSport commentator and national newspaper journalist.
And I'm John Champion.
And we will get an in-depth interview with one of the stars of ITV's World Cup coverage, including what he thinks of a newly promoted side and why his career started with 4 pints of Tetley.
On today's show, I'll tell you why the way Paul Pogba spoke at the end of Saturday's bleak draw and who he spoke to speaks volumes about the future. Sam and I will fall out, probably, as I tell you why Pochettino is better than Mourinho.
And we will tell you about how Stuart Pearce won his fantasy league with one special phone call. And I'm going to be venting about nutrition in the red zone.
All that, plus we put our geekiness to the test in this week's edition of Stat or Spin.
All on the podcast that makes Roy Cropper, whoever that is, look cool. All football commentators are geeks.
With more pens than friends, this is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
So Crook and I were at Brighton versus Tottenham at the weekend. He then watched Yarmolenko miss the easiest chance of the season so far. It took me 6.5 hours to get back from the Amex, and I only actually got home in time to watch Arsenal sneak a win over Everton. But all the while, Michelle had made the cardinal sin. You took a Saturday off, didn't you?
Not my choice. I mean, it was my choice, but let's be honest, you have to go to your brother's wedding, guys.
I don't know about
sorry,
that.
Sorry, I can't come today. Got to speak to Jeff at 3 o'clock. Going to be a bit busy. Won't be able to be there and do the reading and be a big part of your day.
Oh, you had to do a reading as well. So he employed you to go there, basically.
Well, it was a Saturday and he felt like I should be speaking. But I actually got married on a Saturday in the football season. Can you believe that?
Whoa.
Because I got married 2 weeks ago on a Monday during the international break. We've delayed our honeymoon until November during the international break. So basically, the whole wedding has been planned around me not missing any Premier League football.
I understand what you mean, Michelle, because, you know, we all get invited to stuff that we really should go to. And if we had any other job, we would go to it, right? I mean, my missus, she constantly gets annoyed with the fact that she's got to go to a wedding. She's got to go to one on October the 6th on her own, basically, for the whole day. And then I'll just turn up for the drunk bit in the evening.
But at least you get to the best bit. The thing was, as well, I missed one of our really good friends' weddings on the first day of the season. I didn't go to that one. And yeah, if people now have a wedding in the football season, if it's not an immediate family member, it's up in the air from there or not. And yeah. Do you know what? My husband's the same. He's like, oh, it's a Saturday. I want to play football.
There's only certain people that get
that make the cut.
Yeah, that make the cut, that get the privilege of a day's holiday. Crook, I've got to admit, you would have made the cut. I would have taken a day's holiday for you, but I appreciate the fact that you decided to have your wedding on a Monday.
Yeah, during the international break. But I'm just thinking, I did take a day's holiday to come to your wedding because you did get married on a Saturday, Sam. During the football season.
That is actually true. Anyway, we want to talk about the League Cup. I'm going to Manchester United derby and the two Liverpool-Chelsea games in the next couple of days. But I want to talk about where and why Paul Pogba said what he did after the draw with Wolves at the weekend, the impact it's going to have going forward. This was front and centre all day Monday. His quotes, when we are at home, we should attack, attack, attack. That's Old Trafford. We are at home. We should play much better against Wolves. We're here to attack. I think teams are scared when they see Manchester United attacking and attacking. That was our mistake. Maybe the attitude should have been better. We should play better because, again, we're at Old Trafford. We should just attack and press like we did against Tottenham, Chelsea, Liverpool and Arsenal last season. I think he wants to attack. But the key part of this is he didn't have to say it, right, Crook? Just tell us why that is.
So this is the fascinating element of the whole interview for me, because Paul Pogba has stopped in a mix zone. We touched a bit on mix zones and the way they work last week with my ill-fated trip to Portugal. But players, although they're supposed to walk through mix zones after every game, they're not obliged to stop because by the time they get to a mix zone, they've done all the interviews they're contractually obliged to do with the rights holders, the likes of Sky Television and Premier League TV and overseas media. Once they get to that mix zone environment and us minnows, the peasants of the written press, are there with our notepads or our dictaphones hoping to catch a word, they can just ignore you, and normally they do. So the fact that Paul Pogba has clearly made a conscious decision to stop and share those quotes and those really strong views, basically chucking Mourinho under the bus, I think that speaks volumes of where he is in his mind, the relationship between Pogba and Mourinho, which, listen, it wasn't great last season. It's deteriorating week by week. And I just think that's fascinating. He's decided, I'm going to go into the mix zone and I'm going to give these guys a line. I'm basically going to slate the manager's tactics and say, look, guys, we want to play attacking football. Don't blame the players. Blame Jose.
So you don't think for one moment that he could have just said this because he was asked a question and he just wanted to be amiable and he was walking through the mix zone, he saw someone he knew and he just started chatting with them? You think he's made a point of going over and coming out with this? I mean, this is because some people will say, and I'm just playing devil's advocate here, that this is just mischief making from the press. It's all the back pages on Monday morning. You're just trying to get
it's
a divide
word,
between
it?
Pogba and the manager, Jose Mourinho. Michelle?
It's Pogba's words, though, at the end of the day. A journalist hasn't put those words in his mouth. They're direct quotes. And you can't make up what he said. And then, people are going to draw from that what they want to. But as Crook said, he's literally gone there and criticised his manager's tactics. There's no two ways about it. Like, he's gone in there and he knows he's a clever bloke. He knows exactly what he's doing. He got an emoji after himself, for goodness sake. You know, he is savvy. And in my opinion, he either wants out of Old Trafford or he wants Mourinho out. And he's not backwards in coming forwards about it either.
And he's not the only one who feels like that, is he, Chris?
No, and I think Michel's actually hit the nail on the head there, because it's a combination of the two. I don't think it's worked out for Paul Pogba at Manchester United. I think if Real Madrid want him, he would love to go to the Bernabeu. But equally, I think he thinks it was a power struggle here between me and Jose. I can win this one. And I think he can. And you know why? Because Ed Woodward is the CEO now. He is more interested in selling shirts and sponsorship deals than he is on winning the league. As long as Manchester United keep on qualifying for the Champions League, Ed Woodward doesn't care if they end the season trophyless. What he cares about is that Paul Pogba sells shirts in the Far East, sells shirts in America, helps him get big sponsorship deals. So if it comes down to a battle between Pogba and Mourinho, and Woodward has to side with one, Pogba's going to win all day long.
And I totally get that. But Jose Mourinho, who is perceived to be struggling at Manchester United, and maybe it's not the right fit, won the Europa League for Manchester United in 2017. This is less than 18 months ago. In the same year, won the League Cup for Manchester United. Finished second in the table last season. You know, you look around the leagues, you've got no one else who's going to come in. I agree that I think, and I've said this publicly, I think Jose's demeanour, the way he is, it's difficult. But his personality that comes across at the moment is someone who's just not very happy doing the job that he's doing. But behind the scenes, I don't necessarily know if that's the case. I was in the tunnel the other week outside the dressing room, and the feeling that I was getting from the dressing room, the music that was blaring out, he was there, his coaching staff were there, the players all having a great time. The feeling that I got from that experience being in the tunnel was very different to the one that comes out in the newspapers and in the radio interviews and in the columns that you see written throughout the week.
Yeah, I get that. And I do think a lot of what Jose does when the cameras are on or when the microphones are rolling is premeditated and is a little bit of an act. But I'm not convinced it's a happy dressing room. These comments from Pogba suggest it's a far from happy dressing room. The demeanour of Marcus Rashford, when he got himself involved with Bardsley and that headbutt that wasn't really a headbutt, he's not a happy boy. Luke Shaw hasn't been happy particularly. Maybe that's changed now that he's back in the team. you're basically asking who should come in if and when Jose Mourinho goes, because I think he will go. It's inevitable. I'd be surprised if he's still in situ at Old Trafford this time next season. And we saw his successor. I spoke to him in the tunnel at the Amex on Saturday. For me, the only man who can replace Jose Mourinho and try and restore Manchester United to something like their former glories is Mauricio Pochettino.
He loves, Michelle, you'll get this over the course of the next few weeks. He loves Mauricio Pochettino.
I had heard rumours.
Poch is a lovely guy, right? And he's great to be around. He's effervescent. He's fun. He's good to talk to. He's one of the most popular managers on the Premier League circuit. But how do you think that a man who has never won a single honour for any club that he's been in charge of can step into the Manchester United manager's hot seat? That just isn't going to happen, is it? They're going to go for you've already mentioned Ed Woodward. They're going to go for a bigger name with a bigger profile with a better and bigger CV than that. Don't you agree, Michelle?
Yeah, but also, was it May that Pochettino signed, was it a five-year contract to keep him at Spurs? Yep. That takes until 2023. There's got to be some sort of clause in there. You know, look at the mess between Watford and Everton over Silva last season. Tottenham and Daniel Levy are smart enough not to let that happen.
If Pochettino wants the job, he will go to Manchester United. I got to know him very well at Southampton. Even when he was speaking for an interpreter in his press conferences, he was speaking in English to the journalists who turned up week in, week out. The way he manoeuvred that move from Southampton to Tottenham, because Saints didn't want to let him go either. You know, they were trying to dig their heels in. He is ambitious. He used Southampton as a stepping stone. He will use Tottenham as a stepping stone if and when it becomes clear that Levy, even once they move into the new stadium, isn't going to give him the kind of financial support that he's going to help him to win trophies. You keep using this fact that he's never won a trophy as a stick to beat him with. How much has he spent on that Tottenham team compared to Mourinho at United, Klopp at Liverpool, even Chelsea, the money they've thrown it. Manchester City are operating on a different stratosphere in terms of finances. What Poch does is he coaches players and makes them better.
Well, look, I like him, and you know I like him, but he has his faults. And until he irons that out, I don't think he's a candidate. Because spending money doesn't make you a tactical genius. It doesn't improve your tactical changes. It doesn't help you make the right decision when you're playing Juve and you've won the game twice and you're out-coached by Allegri. It doesn't make you make the right changes when you take off Harry Kane, who's one of the better headers, and Danny Rose, who's comes on right for the last few minutes when you're defending for your lives, set pieces against Inter Milan in the San Siro. He made the wrong changes that night. He made the wrong changes against the Juve. He sometimes falters in big games, semi-finals, Tottenham against Chelsea, the League Cup final, Tottenham against Chelsea. There are games that he should have won, games he should have got through, trophies that could have been lifted, but he hasn't done that. And until he works that out, until he comes up with those big changes, those game-changing decisions that makes you stop and go, oh, yeah, I realise he can do it, then he can't be a candidate to move on. Also, do you know what? He's learning his trade at Tottenham. They're in they've got one of the best training grounds anywhere in the country. They've got a good crop of players. They may have some more investment over the next couple of years. You know, it's a good place for him to just keep his head down and keep going for a while, isn't it?
If he can build up a decent tenure at Spurs, get them that trophy, which I don't think he's that far off, and prove that he doesn't need to spend all this money. You know, look at what happened in summer in the transfer window. And he was really behind his squad from what I remember, and correct me if I'm wrong, he wasn't moaning like Mourinho was over the summer at Manchester United. He just got on with it. And I agree, he's got tactically a lot to learn from what Sam was saying there and looking back on some of those games. But if he can, in the next year or so, pick up a couple of trophies, I think then Manchester United would start considering him. I don't know why he'd want to go to Manchester United at the moment either. It's not a happy place to be. Maybe that's because of Mourinho.
You're trying to wind him up.
But
he's an out Manchester United fan, this guy.
But Spurs are doing better at the moment anyway. And it's a happier place to be from an outside perspective. So if I'm Pochettino, do you think?
Tottenham have hit a ceiling. I mean, you've just said if he goes and wins a couple of trophies, he's not going to win a trophy at Tottenham because he can't compete with Manchester City. He can't compete with Liverpool. He can't even compete with Chelsea. He's only competing with Manchester United because Mourinho has made an absolute mess of the job.
apart from the two trophies they won.
Distant past. You can't keep living
on
your past glories.
Come on, let's move on.
You're in a bit ago.
Let's move on, because the guy won a Premier League title 3 years ago. It was a year and 4 months since he last won his last trophy at Manchester United. We ain't going to agree on it. You seem to think that Pochettino is the messiah. I like him. I just don't think he is the coaching genius you make him out to be. I think he's a very, very good coach, but he's still got some things that he needs to iron out. But, you know, listen, if you've got a view on it at AFC Geeks, we'd love to hear from you. Right, okay, let's move on.
Tweet the Geeks at AFC Geeks or get in touch on Instagram.
It's customary at this stage of the podcast to learn what impressed and depressed our geeks over the course of the last week or so.
Well, we did it last week, so I suppose that counts as customary. Michelle, do you want to start? What has impressed you and depressed you?
I will start, and I did go to two games last week despite having a Saturday off for a wedding. Ooh. And I've got to say, the first of those games at Elland Road, wow. First time I've been to Leeds, what an atmosphere. Unbelievable. I'm sure you two will agree with that. And also very impressed with their performance before they went and bust everyone's accumulators at the weekend by losing to Birmingham. But against Preston, they were phenomenal and the atmosphere was deafening. My depressed last week, I've got a couple here. First one being...
You don't want a reputation as a moaner.
Well, I already got one in my house. How bad Reading were when they played on Wednesday evening against Norwich. But also, and I'm going to come on to this in more detail in just a bit, how bad Leeds' food was in the press room. Now, ooh, I'll leave it like that, but I'm going to come back to that in a bit, guys, because I need to. So, Crook, tell me about your depressed and impressed.
Come on, Poch lover.
Well, I was impressed with Pochettino in his post-match interview. Lovely man. No, actually, my impressed is a story that we were party to, Sam, at Brighton from our TalkSport colleague, Stuart Pearce. Because it was a late kickoff, we had the luxury of sort of taking in the 3 o'clock games in the Premier League as we were preparing for our match, and we were watching the goals as they went in on Soccer Saturday. Meanwhile, Sam and I were both constantly checking our various fantasy football teams to see how many points we had in the draft league and in the main league as well. And then Stuart chimed in with a fantastic tale about when one of his sons was at school, probably around about the time that fantasy football first started getting a big reputation. And his mum was saying to Stuart Pearce, look, you've got to help him here. They know you're a professional footballer. He's rubbish. He's getting absolutely battered. He's getting all kinds of stick at school. So he said, all right, okay, look, I'll help him pick the team. And as Stuart told it, the lad slowly climbed the table until he was in second place going into the last weekend of the season. He was literally a couple of points behind the leader. And he was torn over whether to pick Phil Jones or Chris Smalling. It was the year that Manchester United lost out on the last day of the season to Sergio Aguero. Sorry, that brings back a bit of emotion. And basically, Stuart Pearce rung Sir Alex and said, look, I'm thinking of coming to the game. I think he was under 21 manager at the time. I want to take a look at Smalling and Jones. Who's most likely to play? And Sir Alex said, well, Smalling's not going to play. I'm going to play Jones. He said, okay, brilliant. I'll see you at the game. It wasn't for that reason at all. He said to his nipper, put Jones in your fancy team. They kept a clean sheet. They won 1-0, you may remember. And he won the league by a point. Talk about inside knowledge.
It's a great story.
No way.
He rang Sir Alex Ferguson to get inside gen on the team news so he could win his son his fantasy Premier League. That is a fantastic story. That's one of the best stories I've had in a press room for years. That was brilliant, that was. And we were sitting around talking about our fantasy teams, but that one trumps it all. Crook, what's your depressed?
Well, it's Mick Zones again. I think I'm going to be talking about these a lot over the course of the season because I spend most of my post-match time there. I was at Southampton-Brighton last Monday. Cracking game in the second half. Brighton came back and got a draw. Don't know how. I was waiting in the mix zone to speak to Danny Ings because I wanted to get a chat to him about Southampton going to his parent club, Liverpool, this weekend. I was waiting and waiting. I was still there at 11 o'clock because basically Danny Ings and Lewis Dunk, the Brighton defender, were both summoned by the drug testers to give urine samples after the game. And Ings in particular couldn't produce a sample. So I gave up about 11:15 because he still wasn't able to produce. They actually took bottles of Budweiser for him and Lewis Dunk because obviously, as we all know, beer breaks the seal. Still wasn't happening. I think in the end, it was about midnight by the time he actually managed to produce a sample. The mix zone had been packed away by then. I didn't get my interview. It was worse for poor old Dunkey. he had to make his own way home because the Brighton coach drove off and left him there.
It does happen. The thing that impressed me most this weekend, Anthony Knockaert. I thought he was excellent during the game against Tottenham Hotspur. Full of running, really creative down that right-hand side. The only problem was is he didn't finish any of the chances that he got. I thought Harry Kane, in his penalty, was impressive as well. An excellent penalty, one of the best penalties that I've seen. Depressing me, the number of chances in the Premier League this weekend that were missed. The big, big, big chances. Yarmolenko, Sacco, Morata, so many big opportunities. I think Richarlison missed a really good chance as well. Everton had some good chances. And I think that ruthlessness is really going to cost some teams some serious, serious problems. The John Champion origin story involving a killer cricket innings and a lubricated phone call is upcoming. You're listening to All Football Commentators of Geeks. It's the podcast. Please subscribe via iTunes. You can get us on Spotify, Audio Boom, wherever you get your podcasts. We're trying to take you into the commentary box, what it's like to be in the commentary box. We will talk about the games we've been to and that we've seen, but we are trying to give you a sort of flavour of what it's like to be out on the road as a match reporter or a journalist or a commentator. And if you have got anything you want to ask us or talk to us about, at AFC Geeks, we've got a load of questions to get to before the end of the show.
They don't know how to make small talk, but they do know when Raheem Sterling last scored for England. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
If you like the podcast, make sure you rate and review it on iTunes and subscribe via your podcast supplier.
So as well as giving you unprecedented access into the mysterious goings-on in football journalism each week, we'll be speaking to a big-name broadcaster.
Someone who you've probably shared your living room with on hundreds, maybe even thousands of occasions, but you wouldn't recognise if they were sat next to you on the train until you heard their dulcet tones, that is.
This week, I'm delighted to say that we're joined by someone who, alongside Ali McCoist, formed one of the most loved partnerships from this summer's World Cup in Russia.
And the man who lent his voice to the early versions of the much-loved computer game Pro Evolution Soccer. I love that game.
It is none other than my ITV colleague, John Champion. We sat down with him on Saturday in Brighton and asked him if he still liked doing it after 20 years, how much time he devotes to each game, and of course, and this is a really good story, you're going to love this, how it all began.
I fell into it. There was no master plan. Left school at 19, hadn't got a clue what I wanted to do. I'd thought about writing, possibly, and I'd done a bit of work experience with the local paper. But the only sport I could play with any sort of aptitude or ability was cricket. And one day I played in a cricket match up in Yorkshire, where I come from. Got a few runs, retired to the bar afterwards, and the phone rang in the clubhouse, and it was the local radio station, which was the new BBC station in York, my home city. Wanted to talk to me about my marvellous innings that day. By this stage, I'd had, conservatively, 4 pints of Tetley's. So I went to the phone, answered these questions, waxed lyrical, thought nothing more about it, put the phone down, went and had some more beer, and then went home. A couple of weeks later, the phone rang at home, and it was the sports editor of this nascent local radio station, saying, we're just trying to set up a proper sports department. We've got loads of football and rugby to cover this coming winter. We're looking for reporters. We are a bit short, and we love the sound of your voice. You sounded very fluent. As if, I thought, well, I better did after 4 pints of Tetley's bitter. do you fancy giving it a go? Went really well. 6 weeks later, another phone call. We think you've got something here. You've got a chance of making a career of this if you're interested. You know, all you need to do is do a bit more of this, but you have to be a graduate. This was the BBC 30 years ago, so you had to go to uni. My A-levels were so appalling, there was no prospect of me going anywhere near.
What A-levels did you do?
I did 4. I failed English. I failed music. I got a B in general studies, which was, if you remember the paper, that you couldn't revise for it. Yeah. All you could do was read the papers. If you knew current affairs and you'd watched the news at 10 the night before, you were okay.
I got a C in that. That was poor, yeah.
And I got an E in German. So with those, I wasn't going to go anywhere nice. So I ended up at a Catholic teacher training college called Trinity and All Saints, right, which amazingly had its degrees validated by Leeds University. So I managed to do my 3 years degree, ended up BA Leeds, which is a complete con on my part, I have to say. And more importantly, did loads of radio every weekend, earned a bit of pin money to supplement my grant, and got the experience. And by the end of it, I was doing stuff for Radio 2, which was then what 5 Live is now. All the national sport was on there. And they were as good as their word. 6 weeks before my finals, phone call from the BBC personnel office in London. We've got a sports reporter's job at Radio Leeds coming up. We booked you in for an interview. These are the questions we're going to ask you. If you could answer them, you know, rather in this sort of style, in this fashion, it might be quite advantageous. 3 o'clock Friday, don't forget to wear a tie. I got the job. And that was me, really.
And what was your big break into the world of, you know, national broadcasting and television commentary?
Well, the big break for TV commentating was being the Radio 5 commentator the night that Eric Cantona jumped into the crowd at Selhurst Park. So I was doing that with Mark Bright, whose contribution to the moment amounted to three words as Cantona lunged foot first at Matthew Simmons, which was, "Oh my God!" That was Mark Bright, so I was left to carry the rest of it. He actually summed up the moment pretty well. But listening in his bath at home was a guy called Jonathan Martin, who for years was the head of sport at the BBC. And at the time, John Motson was about to have a sabbatical. And he was going to have a year off. And they were looking for someone not to replace him directly, but to come in and make up the numbers. And it was just synchronicity, really. It happened at the right time for me. It made the right impression on him. And I got a year doing Match of the Day, which then led to a permanent job at the end of it.
And that Cantona moment is something that Five Live pay out sort of every 10-year anniversary, 20-year anniversary.
Yeah, usually,
you must hear it time and again.
Yeah, usually Mike Ingham and I get a phone call to go into Broadcasting House and go and do some programme, usually with Jim White from The Telegraph, because he was there and he's a Manchester United fan. So, yeah, every decade we do the same programme again, looking back on that extraordinary night.
And the fact you've heard it so many times, is there anything you wish you'd done differently?
Always. But I think if you ask any commentator about any salient moment in their career, they'd always say, I wish I could have done that better or that better. But at the same time, it's live broadcasting, and I don't think you can really beat yourself up too much. I think in your early years, you probably do, and you try and relive moments and think, what if? But there's no point. There's no point, because you react to the moment. I mean, I have another of those, England-Argentina in 98 in the World Cup.
I was going to ask you about that, because it is about those moments, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you get a bit lucky with that, and you were on that game, weren't you?
Yeah, I was. I was fortunate to do the BBC commentary on England-Argentina, which was... People ask me if there's one game that I would pick out as being above all others in terms of the drama and the impression it made on me, and it would be that, just because there were so many elements to the story that night. But when I hear Michael Owen's Wonder Goal back... you know, I wish I'd done that in a different way. I beat myself up about that for years, and I wasn't as sharp as I could have been on Beckham being sent off. But 20 years on, you know, I've just about stopped worrying now.
How long does it take you to prepare for a commentary?
I guess it depends, Sam. I mean, you know this. It depends what the game is, what the sort of audience is, whether you've done those sides before recently. So when I was doing live Premier League games for national TV or live Champions League.
That would be at Setanta or ESPN.
Setanta, ESPN, and I suppose live Champions League, you know, ITV, and then more recently BT. You give it 2 or 3 days of proper preparation. Now my life is a bit more varied and hectic in that, you know, I used to do 45, 50 games a season, so you could give each of those an awful lot of care and attention. And you turn up feeling super prepared as much as you can be. Now, I did 181 games last year.
Wow.
And about 65 days of voiceovers, you know, narrating various programmes. So consequently, with the travelling, you can't give it as much preparation. So you have to be a little more light in your approach work, shall we say, which I think in some ways actually can benefit you, because I think you can be over-prepared for these things. If you've got one prime focus per week or per fortnight, then everything's building up towards that, whereas... Now you turn up at games and out of necessity, you just have to react to what's happening in front of you. And you've got that latent knowledge inside your head because you're watching so much football and you've done so much football. So maybe that's a better way of doing it.
Do you still enjoy it the way you did when you first burst onto the scene?
Yeah, I do. It still gives me a thrill to do. And I think that's why I went down the route of the spoken word rather than the written one. Because I used to, when I dabbled with thinking of being a journalist... And I was doing work experience, I'd be given an article to write, and it'd be like having an essay to hand in, you know, that dark cloud of homework that we all remember from our school days. Whereas, because broadcasting, by its very nature, is so instant, that's just a whole lot more fun, because you're on the high wire, aren't you, without a safety net. And I think that, for me, is the attraction.
One of the other ways that our younger listeners will recognise your voice is from the Pro Evolution
soccer
games. Yes. Because you were pretty much the first football commentator to go into that market, weren't you?
Well, I think others had sort of dabbled. You know, Motti did quite a bit early in the FIFA era. Peter Brackley, you know, we're sitting here at Brighton. Peter Brackley, who'll be here today, a huge Seagulls fan, was my predecessor on PES. He did 5 or 6 years of it. I did 8. So, yeah, it was a whole new departure. And, you know, when I travel around the world... I've been harangued in hotels in South Africa during the World Cup at 4 o'clock in the morning. There was one occasion where I pitched up in the midst of the World Cup of 2010, off a night flight, got to this hotel in Cape Town at 4 a.m, and all I wanted was my bed because we had another game the next day. And we got there, and there was this guy with a beaming smile. He said, "Ah, Mr. Champion, we've been waiting for your arrival." I said, "We? It's 4 a.m. And all his mates came out, and each of them, they'd all been out, and they decided this was their main chance to make some money. So they'd bought between them about 60 copies of Pairs, and I had to sign every blooming one of them before I was allowed to go to bed, and presumably they then appeared on eBay. And I imagine that my signature probably devalued them rather than enhancing the value. But yeah, you're dealing with a very different audience, half of whom think that you are actually live inside their computer or their TV commentating, which is always, it's astonished me that anyone could ever even think that that might be the case. But there are people out there that think that.
Are you any good at the game yourself?
I'm absolutely useless. And I get pummeled by my kids. I've got three boys, all of whom are far better than I have ever been at Pairs.
Talking of World Cups, and you mentioned the 2010 World Cup, at the most recent World Cup, you were partnered up with Ali McCoist. How was that for a four-week run? I had him for about a week at the end, but you had him a lot longer than I did.
Well, my liver is still in rehab. Because I don't know how he does it. He's 3 years older than I am, and we had a really good time. I mean, not just the broadcasting, but the socialising was.
It sounded like you
was
having
great.
Fun.
We had a great deal of fun. It was as enjoyable a World Cup as I've been fortunate enough to do, and in no small measure was that down to him and his company. And he is one of those rare individuals who has, as you will understand, a natural warmth and charm and charisma that just radiates. You know, he fills a room with joy and happiness. And I've known him. I mean, we worked on the World Cup in 98 together for the BBC, not as commentator and co-commentator, but he was one of the pundits and I was one of the commentators out on the road. So we've known each other a long time, which perhaps helped, but what a man. And I take my hat off to him for his enthusiasm for life and the way he keeps going. I mean, quite often he would be doing a game, then we'd go and wind down for a few hours, and we might get to bed at 3 a.m. And at 5:30, he was up to do Talk Sport's breakfast show from a hotel lobby elsewhere in Moscow, often only semi-conscious. And yet, as soon as the red light goes on...
I think that's actually one of the prerequisites of getting that job.
Yeah, possibly so, actually. Yeah, so I suppose if you've got two semi-conscious presenters, that's the same as having one fully conscious, isn't it? So I take your point. But I don't know how he would collapse at the end of it. So he is human. But no, it was one of the most enjoyable experiences I've had in broadcasting doing that. It was a ball.
And what have you made to the start of the season? Who's impressed you?
I mean, we know who's going to impress us, obviously Manchester City, Liverpool. I've really enjoyed watching Wolves.
Yeah.
Really enjoyed watching Wolves. I did them against Manchester City at Molineux when they might have won. And they were great. I thought they were a breath of fresh air.
They create a lot of chances, don't they? One of the problems they had when I saw them at Burnley, and I saw them on the opening day against Everton as well, was that they didn't seem to convert those chances.
No, but I think that may come. I think Raul Jimenez, you know, he doesn't have a terrific goal-scoring record, but I think he will settle into the Premier League. And I just think that they will be too good at Molineux for the majority of sides. And I think they'll get some points on the road as well. I think they'll finish in the top half comfortably.
Before we let you go, we're going to just do a quick-fire questionnaire to establish some of the information we didn't extract in our long interview. Are you ready for it?
Go on.
OK, here we go then. So 60 seconds to rattle through as many of these as possible. What is the one thing you take with you to every match?
An open mind.
Which summariser keeps you on your toes the most?
Mark Lawrenson, because you never know what he's going to do or say next.
Which one name have you most struggled to get your tongue around over the course of your career?
Socrates Papastatopoulos.
Your favourite app or website to help you prepare for a game?
Good one, BBC website.
Your worst ever journey?
Worst could be today, 4 hours from home to Brighton.
What's the worst place you've ever stayed on your commentary travels?
In Albania.
Why was that?
Brown paper in the hotel windows rather than glass.
The biggest dressing down you've ever been given by a manager in a post-match interview?
Peter Reid, when he had a big beef with Match of the Day. Not with me personally, but I bore the brunt.
Favourite goal you've ever commentated on?
The one that everyone talks about is Michael Owen, so I suppose I go with that.
And your most memorable game?
Most memorable game, England-Argentina World Cup 98, without any question, head and shoulders above anything else.
Which is the most accommodating club in the Premier League?
Of the current Premier League clubs, I would say Brighton is as good as any.
If you could go back in time and commentate any sporting moment, what would that be?
World Cup 66. I don't think my line would be anything as good as Kenneth Wilson-Holmes was, but wouldn't it be great to have it on your CV to have done that?
And finally, what one change would you make to make your job easier?
Private plane for commentators.
We'd all be in favour of that, I think. Great stuff.
John, thanks very much. Really appreciate it.
Okay, no, good fun. Good luck with this.
Tweet the Geeks at AFC Geeks or get in touch on Instagram.
Okay, it's time for Stat or Spin. It's a test of true geekiness, and you can play along if you're listening at home or in the car or even in the gym, wherever you happen to be.
Each of the geeks will give us one stat, a fact from one of their upcoming games or one just gone, and the other two have to work out if it really is a stat or if it's just made up spin.
Yes, geeks get a point for the correct answer, and of course we'll keep a league table. Now, we're going to crown the winner at the end of the season, but we have an ultra keen bean. Sam, I believe you want to go first.
I didn't know about this, but I will go first. I'm happy to do it. I am leading the table after last week's first round, so yeah, no problem. Here we go.
Lift off and the clock has started.
Okay, this weekend saw wins for Liverpool, Manchester City, and a point for Chelsea. Now, they are the current top three in the Premier League. We all know this. The current bottom three, Huddersfield Town, Cardiff City and Newcastle United, all at least 14 points behind that top three. If you factor in 3 points for a win going way back, that is the biggest gap after six games between the top three and the bottom three in the top flight of English football ever. Since records began in 1888, since they first played the Football League for the first ever time, the gap between top and bottom has never been bigger. Is that stat or is it spin?
Is this after six games?
After six games, yeah.
I just remember that season when Derby did terribly. So I think this is... That's really hard, because that's hard to make up. I feel like I want to let Crook go first on this.
Well, I'm going to leap in and say stat. I'm going to say stat, because I think it was too convoluted for Sam to have made it up. And I happen to know that he's been enjoying himself this weekend, so I don't think he'd have had time.
Yeah, I'll go stat as well.
Ooh, you are both correct.
Yes.
Alex, go for it.
It just sounded too good. My stat is about Mark Hughes. Michelle and I are both down at the Southampton training ground earlier in the week, although she snubbed me, didn't come in and say hello, didn't want to post her photo.
I noticed that.
So Mark Hughes, we all know he's got a bit of a reputation for moaning about referees. Even when his player, as Højbjerg did earlier in the season, has taken the most blatant dive in the world, he'll still find a way to blame it on the referee. So my stat is that Mark Hughes' whinge rate is better than his whim rate.
I know that this is a stat because I've seen... I'm sure this is a stat because I've seen it online.
Ooh.
So I think that is a stat. I think,
although he whinges a lot, he has won a couple of really big games towards the end of last season. So now I'm going to go spin.
It is a stat. He's whinged about the referee after six of the games that he's been in charge. Now, he hasn't been in charge that long. He only took over in March. And that is more than he's picked up victories.
How many wins has he got then?
Less than six.
I love the fact that we tried to test him and all he could come up with was less than six. Brilliant, I like that. Michelle, go for it.
Right, you two in the Premier League. Let's bring things back down to a level. Let's talk about League Two and a team I'm covering this week who are now in League One. And I'm talking about Wickham. Now, they scored 79 goals last season.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, as a stat, that they scored the most goals in League Two. Stat or spin?
Oh, who got promoted alongside them? Let's think about this carefully. That's not enough. I'm going to say spin.
Yeah, I think that's spin.
Yeah. I'm going to say spin. That's not enough. For that many games. There's how many games? 46 games in League Two. Did Accrington come up as well last season? I think they did.
Accrington won the league, yeah. But I'm not sure they scored bags of goals either.
Yeah, but I think they scored more than 79. And in fact... No, I'm going spin. I'm definitely going spin. Someone scored more than that.
I'll change it then. If he's going spin, I'm going to say stat, because I don't think Accrington did score that many goals.
Crook, you're right in that Accrington Stanley only scored 76. And Wickham did set a club record in the Football League for themselves by scoring 79 goals. But Luton...
Yeah.
Scored 94.
Oh, no. Yeah. It was far too.
You've colluded there. Sam deliberately talked about Accrington Stanley to make me forget about Luton, who I saw a couple of times, and I saw him ram in. What, they scored 7 goals in 2 successive games, didn't they?
And you didn't remember it, did you?
No, but that's your fault.
With more pens than friends, this is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
Right, OK, let's turn our attention to the Red Zone.
Yes, the Red Zone is the place where every week one of our geeks can let loose about something that really irritates us about the jobs we do, just for 1 minute. And last week, Sam was unhappy about the red numbers on the back of Newcastle's black and white shirts. Mm. And today, it is my turn to have a good old moan.
Oh.
So, I'm going to begin, guys, and I'm not sure if Crook will have much of a moan, but Sam, I reckon you might be on the same page as me on this one, so here we go.
Okay, I'm now looking forward to it.
Now, I want to talk about food, but I'm going to preempt this by saying I'm very grateful that clubs do provide us most of the time with food, but there's certain requirements, aren't there, across the leagues that the clubs are asked to meet. For example, in the Premier League, I think the requirement is something like a 3-course meal. If you go to League Two, you'll get a voucher for a cup of tea. Now, in the Championship, you should get like a hot meal. I think we've all been there and that's what you should get, but we need some consistency. I went to Leeds last week and I got an egg roll. Now, this gets worse when you're vegetarian. Some clubs decide they will cater for you. Some decide that if you're not eating meat, you can have a pile of some rice. How can there be such a disparity? And then, you know, the 1 week you think, right, Bristol City, they won't have a vegetarian option. You take your packed lunch, it's all really healthy. And there's some fantastic option there. But as Crook will know on this one, I know he knows, how can you turn down free food? And then you're double portioning, and then you're getting unhealthy. It's fair to say Football Reporter's diets at times leaves a lot to be desired. Clubs, you need to make it easier for us.
I this is free food, right? Okay, so I think we should just be grateful for whatever we get. But if you gave me a choice to go anywhere on a Saturday afternoon, I'd go to Chelsea, where you get 5-star treatment, 5-star buffet treatment. I mean, you can have as many courses as you like. You don't need no voucher. You just keep going up there with your plate and filling yourself. You don't eat for a week before you go there. I mean, Crook doesn't eat for an hour before he goes there, but you know, everybody else lives it a little bit longer than that. Manchester City, fantastic as well. I did mention to you about the Wembley thing where you have to have the voucher, and if you lose your voucher, you're in all sorts of trouble. But you'll eat anything, won't you, Crook? I mean, Michelle's biggest problem here is that she's a bit choosy, right?
Choosy? She's vegetarian. That's not being choosy.
It is being choosy. You're choosing not to have meat.
Yeah, but there should be an option. We can't go into this right now. But what I'm saying is, Crook, you know, clearly you'll eat a pie. No offence, but if I walk in, I just want vegetarian or not, guys. I want a healthy option. I know football fans go to football grounds. They're like, just want a pie and a pint or whatever, and that's tradition. But I think now we're in the 21st century. We need to be a little bit more dynamic, not just with the free food. Of course, we're grateful for a bit of free food. But even on the terraces, in the kiosks, we need a few more options rather than a pie or a burger. Help us out. You know, I need to keep my body as a temple. And when you're driving 400 miles to Leeds and getting an egg mayo roll at the end of it, that is not the way.
Tweet the Geeks at AFC Geeks or get in touch on Instagram.
Welcome back to the second edition of All Football Commentators Are Geeks. We've had lots of questions coming in from you on social media. I'm going to get to those in just a couple of minutes' time.
When we first devised the podcast, the idea was to transport the listener behind enemy lines, if you like, into the secret conclaves and alcoves that you wouldn't otherwise get access to.
Watching Soccer Saturday, listening to Sam or Alex on the radio, or viewing the highlights of Match of the Day, you can be forgiven for thinking we just turn up, put on the headphones, and away we go.
But being the diligent professionals we are, well, you two are, there is much more to it than that.
So, to give you a better understanding of exactly the preparation and research that goes into a commentary or match reporting shift. Over the next few weeks, we'll be recording a series of short pieces documenting the days and the weeks leading up to the big games and sharing how they pan out.
So next week, I'm going to bring you a flavour of what a week is like for me. I've got three live games to do this week. Old Trafford on Tuesday night, Manchester United derby, Chelsea, Liverpool, Stamford Bridge on Saturday, plus in between times, the Carabao Cup tie with the same opponent. So it's a busy old week of travelling and getting research done.
Yeah, you must be really looking forward to those Chelsea-Liverpool games. It's a fixture that evokes great memories from their Champions League meetings in the past. Chelsea obviously dropping points for the first time at the weekend. Liverpool still with their 100% record. How do you see it going?
Do you know what? Chelsea have done very, very well at Liverpool recently. They've avoided defeat in 12 of their 17 visits to Anfield since the old ghost goal. Do you remember the ghost goal?
One where it hit the red balloon or ball that was on the pitch and
that was Darren Bent. No, the ghost goal was in the Champions League. It was Luis Garcia who didn't put the ball over the line, but they gave the goal anyway, and eventually it knocked Chelsea out of the Champions League and stopped them from going to the final. And Jose was furious, absolutely furious about it. But I suppose this game, the first one in the Carabao Cup, comes down to who has the strongest reserve side, because Jurgen sort of tends to sort of go deeper into his squad for these games, these League Cup games. I mean, last year they went out to Leicester at this stage. Danny Ward, Clavin, Solanke, the Ox, who wasn't fit at the time. John Flanagan played in that game. Will he go for Shaqiri, Solanke, Sturridge as an alternate three? Moreno probably comes in, Mignolet, Fabinho. Chelsea have got Morata, so they probably won't score. But they've also got Fabregas, Barkley, who's going back to Liverpool, the city of Liverpool, Cahill, Zappa, Costa, Moses, who can come in. It's a toss-up, really. I just think Liverpool will take less risks with their lineup because they've got a really tricky run coming up. They've got Chelsea, Napoli, Man City, whereas Chelsea have got, and this is with no disrespect, Liverpool, FC Vidi of Hungary at home, and then Southampton.
These are tough games for us to prepare for, aren't they, Sam? Because you just don't know who is going to play. So suddenly you're delving right into, at times, the under-23 squad, players that perhaps we're not that familiar with and that there's not much information about, and you're trying to top up your commentary notes, and it's a real minefield for a commentator.
I think it's like every week for Michelle when she does like a League One or League Two game, or you know, a Championship. I know you do a lot of those as well, but when you have to be sent down to Forest Green Rovers, for example, it's difficult to garner that much information about them, isn't it?
Yeah, we're quite lucky in that, well, I'm quite lucky that I've made the cut in the last couple of seasons to get the stat emails that sometimes go around Sky Sports News. And we have a stats man called Trev, who's super helpful.
Oh, Trev's great.
Yeah, you know, Trev, but if you speak to the local journos, have a look at the local papers, build up your contacts like that. That's the way I do it. And they've always got a little nugget of information. For example, I'm doing Wickham against Norwich tomorrow night in the Carabao Cup. Now, Norwich I'll be okay at because I've done them a few times this season already. But Wickham, I haven't seen them since, I want to say maybe last September. So right. I've been having a little look what's been going on. And there's some great stuff in there which you can find if you look hard enough. Like Gareth Ainsworth, for example. He's the second longest serving manager in English football. Do you know who the first one is, guys? Just on a little tangent. Do you know who the longest serving manager in English football is?
Eddie Howe.
Jim Bentley.
Correct, Crook. Jim Bentley at Morecambe. So, but it's, you know, well, it's great stuff like that. It's, you know, it's, and you do find it, and it definitely makes a difference. You can just throw that in there when you're doing a quick hit.
Sam Saunders is down at Wickham Wanderers. We can put you in touch with him, and he can give you some information. And we do like to help each other out on this podcast, because you're not going to believe this, Michelle, but up until this week, and this is since I left Sky Sports in 2010, I haven't had any access to any stat packs. I do all of my own research.
Wow.
Until this week.
What's happened this week?
Oh, he made the cut. You talked about making the cut. I finally let him into the secret world of the Premier League stat pack. And this is this is a massive document. It's huge. What is it? 42 pages on every game. You get 12 or 15 stats on every player in the game, plus information about the, you know, the two
I've
clubs.
Oh, I've had these before. I get these when I work for
Sam's
Premier League
new to the party. It turns out TalkSport felt that I was worthy of access to these stat packs, but their main commentator wasn't on the list.
I didn't get them.
That's
never got
hilarious.
Them.
Sam, I've had them, and I've only done a couple of games in the Premier League.
Oh, great. I've only been doing it for like 20 years or something. Anyway, okay, let's get to some of the questions that we've had on social media. Thanks for getting in touch. And if you didn't want to get in touch, you can do at AFC Geeks, at Michelle Owen 7, at Sam Matterface, and at Alex _ Crook if you want to get in touch with us on social media. Had loads of questions actually coming on. I just stuck this out on Monday night and we got loads of people coming back to us. Tom MC on Twitter says, what in the digital age upon us now, Tom MC on Twitter says, with the digital age now upon us, how will radio commentary change, if at all? I'm thinking, he says, we will be watching radio through social media. What do you reckon, Crook?
I don't know. I think maybe you're possibly better placed to answer that question, Sam. I mean, have you had to change your style as technology has developed over the last few years?
I think I'm paying more attention now to things that are happening as I'm doing it, whereas before I just used to switch everything off and concentrate on the game. I don't think we do that now. I think we're very much in touch with the social media as it's happening, so we're trying to react sometimes to that as well. Stan used to be really good at that. He would probably concentrate more on the social media sometimes than he did on the football, which maybe is not the right way around, but I get what he was trying to do, definitely, which was trying to engage with people as he was broadcasting, and he did a really good job of that, I thought. I think one of the things maybe that we do is we'll stream more, so we might stream the commentary box, for example, on Twitter whilst we're doing it, and there may be at some point the option to sort of have the commentators in vision whilst you're watching the game, possibly in the corner or on a different device or with the sound system. I don't know. I do think there's a lot more to come in terms of the way we use social media and the way we do football broadcasting. Michelle, this is one that maybe you can answer because you sort of go around the country and you listen to a lot of commentators. Have you noticed this? This is from Andrew, who says, do you think that commentators and their role is changing because it seems to be less impartial now and more reactive analysis? Commentators have got louder, more shouty, more talkative than the laid-back, gentle style of Barry Davis.
Barry Davis is very different to many commentators today. And I think commentary has generally evolved with modernisation, I guess. People are more animated today. People aren't as afraid maybe to say what they think and have opinions. I think, Sam, you as a commentator, you're perhaps more allowed than Barry Davis was to have an opinion, say, 20, 30 years ago. You can say if you think Paul Pogba's had a rubbish touch, whereas I think Barry Davis might have had to be more diplomatic. I think it's more the summarisers that are more animated now. I think we're getting a better quality of summariser than ever before, though. And you look at people like, I think, Danny Higginbottom. He doesn't shout, but the stuff he knows, he does his research, and he's fantastic. It's definitely down to taste. You might think someone's shouty, whereas I don't think they are at all. I think it's just perception. From watching Jim White when I was younger, I used to think, wow, he's so animated, he's so into this. And now, you know, on deadline day, he comes into his own when he's really projecting. But that's because he's creating the drama of it. And having worked with Jim now, and I know it's not commentary, that's more sports broadcasting and sports news broadcasting, but I understand why people do it. And I think if there's a reason why people are doing it, then that's fine. Don't shout for the sake of it. Don't shout when someone's like Renato Sanchez has passed to the advertising board instead of a player. It's about getting the tone right. And to be fair, without blowing smoke to you, Sam, you know, you're one of the commentators, I think, that gets that level right.
Well, we all get it wrong. And do you know what? This is another tweet that came in as I put this question out to social media from Taz, who's a Spurs fan. He says, had to switch you off, Sam, on Saturday due to the fact that you had a shocking anti-Spurs bias. To say your commentary didn't match the pictures would be the biggest understatement of all time. And the pure excitement in your voice every time Brighton got near our goal was shocking. Now, I'm not anti-Spurs. I think I gave the Tottenham goals more than I did the Brighton goal because the Brighton goal didn't mean anything at the end. But I thought I got really excited and my voice certainly got really up every time Tottenham went forward. But I think people sometimes think, maybe because they know of your allegiances, I don't know, or just because they see it through the prism of their own football club, that you're anti them. Which, I don't know. You were sitting next to me, Crook. Did I sway towards Brighton? I don't think I did, but did it come across like that to you?
No, it didn't come across like that to me at all. But it's interesting you mentioned the word allegiances there, and I think that's definitely something that's changed over the last maybe even as recent as the last decade, I think it's okay now for football commentators and football broadcasters to be reasonably public about the team they support. I think most people looking at your social media, certainly looking at mine, could probably work out who our team is. Now, that doesn't mean if we're covering said team, we're going to be biased towards them or against the opposition. But I think going back 20, 30 years, if you were to say, who does John Motson support? Who's Barry Davis's team? I think they were a lot more secretive about it and they were encouraged to be. Whereas now I think with social media, our bosses don't mind us having an allegiance to one club if it helps make good programming.
Can I just jump in there? Because today I got told that it's best not to be too public in who you support by someone quite senior in a media organisation. And they told me that. I thought, okay, fair enough. Because he didn't know who I supported, because actually I don't talk about it a lot because I like to go and do their games. And maybe I'm more of that old-fashioned view that when I do them, I don't want to get accused of that bias. But Crook, I do agree with you to an extent. I don't see why it matters. It's not like you're going to go into a game. Man United you support, right?
Yeah.
You're not going to go into a Man United game being like, you know, we. You'd never speak like that. So no. It's about our bosses respecting that we're professional enough to maintain those standards. And I agree with you, Sam. I think, and Crook, that maybe fans are skewed by their own bias and they think they're hearing something that they're not.
Okay, let's do one more question because we've had loads in and I'm really sorry if we haven't got to your question, but the ones that we did have sort of taken over a little bit. So I appreciate those. Okay, this is the last one. It's from Grant on Twitter. And this one I'm going to give to you, Michelle, and then I'm going to come back to Crook on this. What is there to say to people who give female commentators a hard time because they don't sound right?
I don't think there's anything to say to them because that is such an invalid point. You know, it's the 21st century. You speak to women on a daily basis. Are you telling me they don't sound right just because their voices are slightly higher in tone? As a woman, we're told to keep our voices lower when we broadcast. So any women you watch or listen to reporting on sport would already have brought themselves down and have had some degree of training or advice to sound, I guess, more manly. Now, bear that in mind, that it's not an unnatural way to speak. You sort of train yourself to do it anyway when you're commentating. But you get these people that tweet you saying it's shrieky or it's high-pitched and they don't like it. Well, tell that to your wife when you're arguing with her. You know, it's humans. It's how we speak. And that is never going to change. It's just that in the 21st century, everyone's finally realised that women are fine to talk about football as well. I promise you that in 10 years' time, this will be the norm. You'll have an equal amount of women commentating on Match of the Day as you will men. Yes, you still see those tweets come up, unfortunately, criticising Match of the Day for having women on. But now, on Soccer Saturday, Bianca was the first woman, and then it was me. Now we've got Faye. I think it's only a matter of time until we get more. Talk Sport, I know there's a few women on there as well, with you guys.
Yeah, well, this season we've increased the number of presenters and reporters that we've got, and I think that's a commitment that we made, definitely. I don't get that the voice thing, because I think it doesn't matter if you're... I mean, look, men and women commentators, whoever they are going to get a load of jip on Twitter and Instagram or whatever, because that's just what happens to everyone. But the fact is that I think if your voice is good enough and if your broadcasting is good enough, then there's not a problem with it. I mean, I listened to Vicky in the World Cup. I was in Russia, but I was watching on a service that we had over there for broadcasters, and I thought she was excellent. I thought she was very, very good, as she has been throughout her career. But I actually think her voice is very, very good. And if you listen to the cricket coverage and the German football coverage, there's a couple of great female commentators. I mean, the Bundesliga, there's one lady that does the Bundesliga and has been doing it for years, does Champions League and all sorts. She's brilliant. I think she's close to being the number one I think it's Sky Deutschland. I'm not entirely sure on that, but there's certainly a very high profile female commentator, and she does it on her own with no summariser. So I certainly think that's something that is going to happen more and more over the course of the next few years.
Yeah, we're moving into the stage now where women are not there because of how they look; they're there because of what they know, their knowledge. And one thing, just to add, final point on this, is that sometimes I see tweets and things on social media like, oh, they've never played the game. Well, sorry, Crook and Sam, as far as I know, you were never professional footballers. So that's an absolute irrelevant point.
It's true. You've played higher than us.
But this is true.
I think what's interesting on this subject of more female broadcasters coming into the game is the changing attitude from the actual players and the managers as well, because I've heard some horror stories going back not that too many years. Managers very disparaging when a woman would ask them a question at press conferences, players disrespectful in a sort of mixed zone environment. That doesn't happen now, and I think it's a fantastic innovation, really, the way it's gone.
Okay, well, remember, if you want to get in touch, you can do.
Yes, remember to subscribe and tell everyone about us and tweet us, or you can get us on Insta as well. It's at AFC Geeks.
So that is just about all we have time for this week. Thank you for all your questions. Thank you for downloading it and getting on board with the journey nice and early. Hopefully you've had as much fun as we did. We'll all be back with another very special guest next week. Thanks for listening.
Tweet the Geeks at AFC Geeks or get in touch on Instagram.